So it has been discussed already quite a couple of times during this workshop, and that is let's see if this works a bit better. And that is how to basically set up your microscope in such a way that at least your optics are not limiting you to get to high resolution structures. So well, there's many high resolution structures out. So what should you do to at least make sure that your microscope is in a state that you're able to achieve these types of structures? Now, to tell you what you should do, I always start with a couple of slides which you should not do. And of course, experts can do this, but since we are getting more and more people in the field that are not known to electron microscopy, it is good to at least train yourself not to realign your microscope daily. There are still many labs that think this is necessary to every day start in the morning with a full microscope. Yeah.
Are you talking about full alignments?
Yeah, full column alignments.
So, but tuning every day is A-OK.
Yeah, so I'm coming to that, the difference between tuning and alignments. So what should you tune, what should you check, and what should you completely align? So it's not going to be the first time that I enter a lab and there are 30 different, and that's not exaggerating, 30 different alignment files of 15 different people on the microscope. So at some point you don't know anymore which alignment file is right. And also, if you are planning to do an alignment, then or completely do the column alignment, and you don't know what each step is doing, it might be better not to do so and let somebody else that does know what each step is doing actually do it, for instance, a service engineer. Now, also, the user is often more unstable than the microscope itself. It is also not going to be the first time that there is a very stable room and a very stable microscope, but 30 different users, and each user is realigning the microscope based on the previous user. Some more facts. If you are the happy owner of a Titan and you used to have a Techni or some different manufacturer brand, you have to realize that these microscopes, although they're all electron microscopes and the principles are similar, they're not the same. The optics design is different, and also the alignment strategy is different from one microscope to the other. And the question already came up. You have to distinguish between a column alignment and a direct alignment. So FEI has this step called the direct alignments, and the wording might be a bit wrong. We're thinking about changing that into daily tuning or something like that. A column alignment is a complete alignment of the microscope column to make sure you have light at the end of the bottom. The direct alignments is daily tuning operations like stigmation, pivot points, and those should not take more than 5 minutes to do. And also, if you think something is wrong with the microscope and you're a bit more experienced and you know which alignment step actually corrects that, and you're planning on changing only that correct alignment step and then recreating a new alignment file because you don't want to align the complete column, please don't do that, because many of these steps are interlinked. So if you change one step, it has consequences for other steps. So you're solving one problem, but you're creating 15 others. So if you decide to realign the column, you have to be aware that will take you an entire morning. So what should you then actually do? There's only a couple of things that are important. The microscope is actually very, very stable, especially if the room is stable. There's only one thing that changes in a microscope, and that is the gun area. So the FEC is the only thing that changes over time. So only a gun alignment is something you have to do on, let's say, a 2-monthly basis. But for the rest, it's everybody uses the same routine every day. You would be surprised how stable the microscope actually is. Now, the things that are important are to work at eucentric height and eucentric focus. And the reason for that is that the basis of the full column alignment is done at eucentric height and at eucentric focus. So don't deviate from that. Don't start aligning your microscope in a defocus setting, because you're completely misaligning your microscope. It will be aligned for -3 microns, but for all other focus settings, it will be completely misaligned. So the basis of the microscope alignment is that you are at your centric height, which is the optimal position between the two objective lens pole pieces, and at your centric focus, which is the focus plane at that position. Then parallel illumination. This is very, very important. If I read most of the cryo-EM papers and I look at the experimental section, many of the papers have been published while not being parallel. And some are horribly off parallel illumination, and not a little bit. And I'll show you later actually how big your beam should be when you're parallel, and many people are often shocked when they see that. So parallel illumination is very important. Stigmation is important. Coma-free alignment, Holger Stark already mentioned that, is an important factor. And with the new direct electron detectors, dose rate is also important. Now, if you do everything right, it should not be too difficult if you own a Cryos to, on a routinely basis, every day shoot about this. So at the end of my talk, I'll give you a couple of simple steps to go through. If you do that right, then you can shoot these images very routinely, and you'll have tone rings running out to 2 angstrom resolution or 3 angstrom and beyond. And tone rings is actually the total sum of your entire microscope quality. If there's something wrong, you will see it immediately in your tone rings. So if your tone rings are round and they continue out in your rotational average to 2 angstrom resolution, optically you're fine. If you're not capable of getting high resolution data, it's something else, it's not your microscope. So a microscope is a rather simple thing. It has a source where the light comes from that gets condensed onto your specimen, where your imaging lens is, then you have a picture, and this picture is projected further or closer away with respect to the camera. Now, if we do alignments or tuning, we always start from the top. So let's start at the source, which is the gun area. Now, the source is unstable and is per definition unstable. This is a fact of life, and we cannot change that. But it is not that unstable. Now, there's 2 factors that influence the stability of your gun. One is the temperature at which the tip is run. Most FECs are Schottky emitters, so they're heated. This temperature can be changed by a service engineer, but not by a user. What you can change as a user is the extraction voltage. Now, the tip can have 2 forms. One form is a single facet, because the tip is a crystal. So if the tip is a flat surface, a single facet, it is extremely stable and has a high emission, has a high brightness. That surface can collapse under the wrong or right conditions into a more rounded shape, and it's basically crystal growth. It's roughening of the surface of the tip. This is governed by the entropy, delta S, so temperature influences this roughening. And also the extraction voltages is a similar kind of, can also be transformed into temperature. So it's basically temperature that drives this. Now, if the temperature is low, your delta S, T delta S is low, so that's good for stability. And the same happens when the extraction voltage is high. So these two, low temperature, high extraction voltage, will push the tip to this situation. High temperatures and low extraction voltage will push the tip to this situation. Now, by itself, the tips can collapse occasionally when you have a stable situation into this, and then recover by itself back into that. It's a metastable state, and this is called ring collapse. Now, this is different for each tip in every different microscope. We cannot prevent it. We can only influence the frequency at which it occurs. Now, if it occurs on a daily basis or within your experiment, that's when it's going to hurt you, because what it looks like is you will see that the intensity will go slowly down, and this is over the course of 1 day, 2 day, and then in a couple of hours you see a steep drop down to 50% or so, and then it goes back up and you have your intensity back. So my advice always is, if you have collected your data set, always check your data set on the amount of counts you have in your images. Simply plot the counts versus time, and if you see a profile that shows this, you have suffered a ring collapse. Now, if you get ring collapses every week, you should call us. Don't go to your colleagues and say, do you know what it is? If you have an unstable tip, please report it to us. We have had 4 instances of tips that were very unstable with ring collapses, but we found out recently there were more, but these people simply did not report it to us and kept on working, and they thought there were other things wrong with the microscope. So from now on, please check your data and see if you see these types of effects. There is no basis on no specification on how often you should see them or should not see them. It's a little bit personal. If you see a ring collapse every 3 months or so, that's relatively normal. If you see it every week, that's not normal. And the question is, where do you think it needs to be replaced? There are things that we can do. We can actually lower the temperature of your tip and therefore bring it in a more stable state. So it's the same as the front lights of your car. It's impossible to predict whether or not your tip is going to be stable or not. Now, if we want, we could, of course, make the temperature down to room temperature and the extraction voltage as high as we can. However, if you increase the extraction voltage, I have a pointer that's much better than my mouse. If you increase the extraction voltage too high, you get a larger energy spread of your electrons, and that's going to affect your coherence. I, on purpose, not mention the word coherence here, because coherence is a difficult thing to grasp, because there's 2 forms. You have spatial coherence and temporal coherence. The increase of energy spread affects your temporal coherence, but you get a brighter tip, and that improves your spatial coherence. So your temporal coherence goes down, but your spatial coherence goes up. And however, where this will hurt your data, we don't know. But from the data we've collected so far, if you bring your tip up to the highest extraction voltage, which is 4,500, we don't see 1 tone ring more or less. So it should not affect your data up to, let's say, 2 angstrom resolution, and we're far off from that in structural biology. So my advice is to run the tip to the highest possible extraction voltage, which is 4,500, because then you simply have a more stable tip. We could also lower the temperature to room temperature, so then you have what is known a cold fech. Our competition builds these types of tips. Now, the tip would be then enormously stable, but the problem with the cold fech is that your vacuum is not good or good enough. So you always will get a layer of oxygen deposited on the top of the tip. And this process starts immediately after you flash it. So a cold fech needs to be flashed. So you heat a cold fech so to remove all the oxygen. And after that, you have about 8 hours of time while the intensity is slowly dropping to 0. That's something that you basically don't want to have in structural biology, because your dose is also going down. So we cannot lower the temperature too much, because then we have other unwanted effects. So we need to find an optimum where the extraction voltage is high, the temperature is not too high, where we have acceptable energy spread, good brightness, and a reasonable stability. Now, how to set your guns. What you can do as a user is do a gun alignment, and there's a couple of things in your gun settings that you can change. High tension, the extractor, and the gun lens. Now, if you want to do this, you have to ask yourself the question, there is a crossover in the gun lens, and this crossover might do something or might not. So who knows what happens when you change the high tension, who knows what happens when you change the extractor, and who knows what happens when you change the gun lens. Is the crossover going up, down, or does it stay the same? Now, if the answer on any of these questions is no, it's better not to touch the gun, because you might be misaligning your gun and then you start already wrong from the source. And the answer is actually this. So most people use a gun alignment if they change the high tension. Now, if you lower the high tension, the gun crossover goes down and you get into a bad situation the moment it drops below the C1 aperture, because then you're in so-called telefocal mode, and that's something the alignments cannot handle. So you always want to have your crossover above your C1 aperture. So when you lower the high tension and the crossover goes down and goes in telefocal mode, you have to compensate that with a stronger gun lens to pull the crossover back in and to reach the same saturation as you started at. Now, if the high tension is too low, and that normally happens between 120 and 80 kilovolts, the gun lens is not strong enough anymore to pull the crossover back in, so the only option you have left is lower the extraction voltage. And like we have seen here, lowering the extraction voltage is bad for the stability, so you're going to see ring collapse. Or a split tip. Split tip is when you have two facets forming at the surface, so you have two sources, and that looks like a split tip. So a split tip is not really a source split in half, it's just two emission sources. Now, since we don't do STEM, and we like to work at the highest possible high tensions, especially with the direct electron detectors, the higher the high tension, the better it is, there is no need anymore to go to lower high tension, only if you are unfortunate enough that you own CCD technology. Then lower high tension is better for you because your sensitivity of your camera is so much better at lower high tension. But if you don't, then it's better to not touch your gun settings at all. It's best to keep the extraction voltage as high as you can, the high tension as high as you can, and the gun lens basically as weak as you can, because then your crossover is closest to the edge, so you have the most light coming from your tip. And with a lot of light coming from your tip, you can use a small C2 aperture, and you will see in the next slides why a small C2 aperture is nice to have.
So I had a quick question.
Yes.
If your lab has STEM 2,
yeah.
And let's say you not change your high tension or extraction voltage,
yeah.
Do we have to worry about any settings changing between going from STEM mode to maybe low to STEM mode?
No, because that's here. So that's this slide, actually. That's called the FEC register. So I anticipated that already. The gun is not so unstable that you need to align it daily. So basically, this is a profile of a bad gun, and this is a profile of a good gun. Try to avoid spot size 1, because spot size 1, everything is to the max, so it will never look nice. Now, the STEM people often work at spot size 9, 10, or 11, and also at a higher gun lens. So you see this is an example, STEM, so your gun lens 6. So they have a tendency to work in nanoprobe at a high gun lens and a large spot number, and we have a tendency to do exactly the opposite. So that's why STEM and TEM people normally have a problem communicating with each other. Now, if you change the setting of the gun, please don't do, and that's what a lot of people do, they go to the direct alignments. So in this case, you should not go to direct alignments, because in the direct alignments, you only align your gun shift and your gun tilt, but not the rest. And the most important thing is actually your gun crossover. There's one step in here, which makes sure that the gun crossover here is exactly at the same position for each setting that you apply. And if your first crossover is always at the same position, that means all the rest downstairs is also the same. So if you make sure that in the gun alignment, you do this step very accurately, you do not have to realign your entire column. So what you do is you do a gun alignment, and I normally do this every 2 months or so because the gun would slowly change. I do a complete gun alignment. It takes me not more than 5 minutes to do. It's rather simple. Make sure that the gun crossover, which is only focusing the beam to a spot, is done very accurately. And then you save the alignment in the FEC registers. So we have two things. We have an alignment file and we have a FEC register. And that's what they're actually for. So because the gun is the only thing that is not stable in your microscope, we don't want you to realign the entire column every time the gun is changed. So you only do the gun alignment, you change that in the FEC register. So if you have a well-behaving microscope, you should have one alignment file per high tension, and every alignment file is accompanied by one FEC register. And then you have a FEC register for the TEM people and one for the STEM people. And that's about it. So if you would change high tension or change mode, you simply load your 300 kV alignment file and you apply the FEC register of the mode that you have. And that's then it. Because the FEC register overrides the gun alignment from 20 years ago with the current gun alignment, because the column alignment is further invariant. If you make a new fact register, please delete the older one. And the same goes for the alignment file, also delete the older one. If you are not sure if you should delete the older one, because you might think you did something not perfect or not right, it might be better that you don't do the alignments, because then obviously you don't know exactly what you're doing. Yeah. No. Do the whole thing because it interlinks. It depends on the previous one, on also this one and that one. So you really need to do. But the gun alignment doesn't take you more than 5 minutes. And actually, the longest routine is this one.
Yeah.
So by not doing these two, you're saving 1 minute. So yeah. Yeah. If you press this button, you get a flap out and it tells you which is saved. So what is always saved is the gun, and then there are some settings that are optional, which are some of the direct alignments, so stigmator settings, but those you need to check. If you don't have these, by default, they're off. So if you also want to have your coma, your direct alignment saved, then you need to check the checkboxes that are there. So that's the gun. That's basically the only thing that changes, because the rest depends more or less on the room. So if the temperature in the room is unstable, then your column alignment changes. But otherwise, it's actually quite stable. And for a Titan, it's so stable that I still have one alignment file of the first Titan Cryos in Eindhoven. If I go back there and load it, it's still aligned. So let's go to the condenser system after the gun. This is the most important thing, more or less, what you should be taking care of in structural biology, and that's to parallel illuminate your specimen. Because if you're not, if your beam is convergent, what you do with single particle, you apply a focus spread, because you need to have a defocus range, and changing the defocus is the same as moving your specimen up and down. So if your beam is convergent or divergent, the projection of moving your specimen up and down will give you magnification changes in your image. And depending on how parallel you are or how off parallel you are, it's going to be progressively worse. So if you have a convergent angle that is extremely large and you have a large focus range, then you might end up with having magnification changes in your image that are in the order of angstroms or maybe more. But angstrom magnification changes you will not be able to see by eye. However, the computer will start to average all those particles together, and there goes your resolution. So depending on how parallel you are, your resolution also goes to higher values. Now, what is parallel illumination? It basically means that if there is a crossover in the front focal plane of the lens, then per definition, the rays are going parallel through your microscope. But we have a problem. We cannot see or find the crossover in the front focal plane. Now, luckily, an electron microscope is not one objective lens, but two. So there's also a back focal plane. So when the rays enter parallel, the imaging lens, then they should also be focused in the back focal plane. So parallel illumination, that is if the last crossover is at the front focal plane, so that's this one, the last crossover of the condenser system, then the diffraction pattern, which actually lies in the crossover of the back focal plane, should be in the back focal plane, and then per definition, you have parallel illumination. And then with a two condenser lens system, here the third lens is off, everything is fixed. There's nothing more you are allowed to do. So we cannot find the front focal plane, so we have to perform a trick. So we have to make use of the fact that there's also a back focal plane, because where is the back focal plane? That should be where the diffraction pattern lies. Now, you need to put your eyesight at the back focal plane. You have to focus the back focal plane. So to see it, you switch to diffraction. But if you switch to diffraction, it depends on how parallel you are, if you're actually at the back focal plane. So you cannot use the diffraction pattern to determine if you're looking sharply at the back focal plane. You have to use something that is fixed and is mechanical in the back focal plane to actually make sure that you're focused at that sight. Now, what is in the back focal plane? That's the objective aperture, or at least in FEI microscopes, it is. So what you need to do is you need to use the focus button to not focus your diffraction pattern, but you need to focus the objective aperture. So if you use focus to sharpen the objective aperture, you know that you're looking focused at the back focal plane. And then you use intensity, you use your C2, to focus the diffraction pattern, because when I'm looking at the back focal plane and my diffraction pattern is focused with intensity, I'm parallel illuminating my specimen. So when are you parallel? When you simultaneously have the objective aperture and the diffraction pattern focused. Actually quite simple. Now, so what you should do is when you switch to diffraction and you put in the objective aperture, and I always misalign the objective aperture because then you can see the edge a little bit more clearer, because if you don't, then it might coincide with a dark spot and it will be very difficult to sharpen your objective aperture. So I on purpose misalign my objective aperture in diffraction mode. And then what you should not do is use focus to focus your diffraction pattern, because then you have a blurry objective aperture and a sharp diffraction pattern. But what you should do is the other way around. You should use focus to focus your objective aperture. And then you use intensity to focus the diffraction pattern, and then you have a situation like this. You probably need to iterate this, because if you change the intensity, this will blur out a little bit. But always make sure that when you focus the edge of the objective aperture, you do that with focus, and the diffraction pattern you use intensity. Well, it becomes brighter. So if you basically, the optics are not perfect, so the lenses do crosstalk a little bit. So you'll see that there is some change. The crossovers do move a little bit. So if you change the intensity, then your objective lens is going to change a little bit. It's not that much in a Titan, but on a Techni there's only one big column, so everything is a little bit communicating with each other. So if you have that, if you have a focused diffraction pattern with intensity and a focused objective aperture with focus, you switch back to imaging mode, and then you should be parallel. Now, a couple of things to make sure that your microscope is well aligned. If you're parallel illuminating your specimen, if you change your spot size, it should not change. Of course, if you change C1, your crossover changes, but if you notice carefully on the microscope, the moment you change C1, you also see C2 changing a little bit. So there is an alignment that makes sure that the crossover stays in the same position. So if you change spot size, parallel illumination should not change that much. So if you change spot size while being like this, it should actually still be like that. It can change a little bit, but you should not be miles off. So when you change spot size, parallel illumination should remain roughly parallel. If you change magnification, that should of course not change parallel illumination, because magnification does the projector system and that has nothing to do with your illumination system. If you change your C2, parallel illumination should also not change. This is often a difficult one for people that do STEM, because if you change C2, you're changing the convergent angle. So in STEM, it will have an effect, but in STEM you have a focused beam when you're illuminating your specimen parallel. And if I go back all the way here, you'll see that if I cut off the beam smaller with a different aperture, this crossover does not change. That will remain in the same position. So parallel illumination does not change. Now, still while being parallel, the only way, since you cannot, with the two condenser lens system, change your illumination settings, you have to live with the beam size that you get. So the only way to change the size of your beam is by changing the C2 aperture. There's no other way with a two condenser lens system. And that should also be consistent. So if you change your C2 aperture from 100 to a 50, the size of your beam should be half. If that's different, then again, there is something in your alignment that is not good, or your apertures are actually not 150, but maybe 170. What also should be constant is the size of the beam. So if you change the spot size, because your C2 is your limiting aperture, so your spot size should also not change the size of the beam. And if you change magnification, also the size of the beam should not change, because you're only projecting it closer and further away. Now, what's the result? It depends a bit on your lens configuration. So most people use the microscope in microprobe mode. Nanoprobe mode is more for STEM. Microprobe mode on a TechNi with a 150 micron C2 aperture and a twin lens will give you a nice parallel beam of about 30 microns. So that is actually rather large. And I don't know if anybody is doing that. Because if you have an R22 grid, most people don't make the beam larger than actually the flu screen what they're going to see, because they don't know how much area they're going to destroy. So by definition, when people set the illuminated area, normally the beam is roughly the size of the flu screen or a bit larger. And that's not a little bit of parallel illumination. That is miles from parallel illumination, because normally that's about a 1 or 2 micron beam. But parallel with these settings is 30 microns. So if 30 microns is parallel, then a 2 micron beam, that's almost STEM. So you shouldn't be surprised that you then cannot get to high resolution. So we want to have a smaller C2 aperture, because 150, yeah, you should simply not use 150 in microprobe, unless you want to burn this amount of area. That's fine. But then you need to realize that with your automated routine, with an R22 grid, you have to skip 1, 2, 3, 4 holes before you take another image. Now, to increase the throughput, you can make the beam smaller. So we take a 50 micron C2 aperture, and then you're left with a 10 micron beam. Still rather big, but this would be acceptable. So now you can take every other hole, you can take a picture, and also in this direction. So your throughput goes up, and you're also parallel. However, you have a little bit less light, because your C2 aperture is smaller. Hence, you want to have a bright tip. You could also switch to nanoprobe. So nanoprobe basically is a STEM mode. But if you use nanoprobe in TEM, what you basically make is a STEM beam, a focus beam, but then parallel. So you can make a quite small beam with that. So 150 micron C2 aperture in nanoprobe is about 5 microns. And then you can take every hole an image. But there is a penalty. But because you can make a smaller beam, there's an extra lens that starts to react in nanoprobe, which is a mini condenser lens, but it goes a bit too far to explain that. But everything goes 5 times or 6 times faster. So the problem starts when you are not perfectly parallel, because there's only one setting where you're parallel. So let's say you can find that more or less, but what does it mean when you're not perfectly, when you're off? Now, you have to realize that if your beam is large, and these are the quantifold holes, let's say I have a large beam illuminating that area, if I'm then imaging one picture in this hole with a small camera, and I have a large beam, and it's not exactly parallel, it's going to be less of a problem in the center than at the edge. So the larger your beam is, and you're not exactly parallel, it's not going to be such a problem if your beam is large. If your beam is small, so if you're illuminating one hole, so in this situation, in nanoprobe, and you're off, you're going to see that in the image, because the problems at the edge are coming into your image. So therefore, on a TechNi, it's not advised to use it in nanoprobe. Even though this has the highest throughput, it's better to do something like this. So you have an acceptable C2 aperture. You can even go to a smaller C2 aperture, but these are difficult to align. So here you still have a decent amount of light. It's still relatively easy to align it. And you can take a picture every other hole. Plus, the central part is imaged, and that is more or less as parallel as you can get. So I normally advise to do this. That means you have a 10 micrometer beam. And that's much bigger than the flu screen. You can also check it. This is the empirical way to check if you're parallel. So if you have your illuminated area and you take a picture with gold beads, for instance, and you take a picture at minus 5 and minus 15, and you overlay these two images, if you toggle between the two images and you see that the gold beads are moving, you're not parallel illuminating your specimen in this focus range. Now, gold beads are accurate, but I wonder if you can see two or three angstrom movements in that. So what I normally advise is to do the trick with the diffraction pattern, use a 50 micron aperture, 10 micron beam, and take a picture every other hole on the TechKnife. And then comes the Titan. Now, a Titan has a third condenser lens. And why is this interesting? Because the third lens makes sure that the final crossover, so the last crossover of the condenser system, is always at the same position. So the last crossover of the condenser system is always at the front focal plane. So per definition, you are parallel illuminating your specimen. Of course, in the alignment file, you need to tell it in one alignment step where that is. So if you do that step wrong, then your entire microscope is misaligned. And that step is exactly that is exactly this step. So there's one step in the Titan alignment where it asks you to put in the objective aperture, make it sharp, focus the diffraction pattern, that's parallel illumination. If you do that step wrong, your entire Titan column alignments are messed up. So if you do it right, you're always parallel, and then in the range of the lens, because this is a lens, it cannot go bent indefinitely back and forth. Whenever you're in the range and the Titan tells you when you're in the range, you are parallel illuminating your specimen. So you now have a range, not anymore a spot. That means that whenever on a Titan you are in the parallel range, and you can simply check it because the microscope tells you you're now parallel. If you press eucentric focus, remember that's important because the whole alignment is at eucentric focus. You insert an objective aperture and you press diffraction, you must see this. If you don't see this, then there's something seriously wrong with your alignment. So this is a way to check whether or not your Titan or the most important part of your Titan is well aligned. This must happen. And if you then change your intensity throughout the range of being parallel, and at the edges of the range it will not be exact, but in the middle part of the range, this will not change. Your C2 aperture will remain, your objective aperture will remain focused, and so will your diffraction pattern.
You said that the edges of the range is not really exact, but of course you try to make it pretty small, like a ruler. And for example, Titan gives like a 1.2 micrometer beam, where it says it's not parallel. Is it better to use it than not with 1.21, but rather with 1.4? Or how exact is the edge not parallel?
You can actually see that. So you switch to diffraction, and if you see this, it's perfectly fine. If you see that the diffraction pattern is getting blurry, then I would not use it. So because everything is parallel, on a Titan, I normally go to nanoprobe. So I can actually put it, I took the slide out because some people thought it was too difficult. But since the question comes up, I can show it. Where is it? That's what it looks like. Now, this is the convergent angle plotted onto the illuminated area. And basically, in microprobe, and this is then shown for 150 micron aperture and the 50 micron, this is your parallel range. So you see it comes in, the convergent angle goes to zero, so there is no more convergence, so then you're parallel. So this part is parallel. And then with the 50 micron, that part is parallel. And if you switch to nanoprobe, and here you can also see that if you're off in microprobe, you're around one, this is logarithmic, so you're 1 milliradian convergent, but if you're off in nanoprobe, you're 10 milliradian convergent. So you can better be off in microprobe than off in nanoprobe. Now, this is where the fun starts, so around 1 micrometer, then where should you be? So let's say if you have a 1.2 micrometer beam, you can choose to be at the edge of microprobe with a 50 micron aperture, but you can also go to nanoprobe with the 50 micron aperture because then it begins here and it starts there. You're nicely in the middle of that range. So if you want to have, let's say, a 1 micrometer beam, I normally switch to nanoprobe, because then I'm in the middle of the range. If I'm doing tomography and you have larger area beams, I'm doing macroprobe. So basically, as a rule of thumb on a Titan Cryos, if your beam, if you're doing single particle analysis and you have a small beam in the order of a micron or less, I'm in nanoprobe. If I'm doing tomography and I'm in the order of 3 microns or so, I'm in microprobe. And go back. So in nanoprobe, you can make very small beams that are still parallel. So you're not limited with your throughput anymore by the dictation of having parallel illumination. So then the size of your beam, you normally decide on the size of your camera, which depends on the magnification. So for instance, a lot of people use 1 angstrom pixel size. So that means on a 4K camera, you have a 400 by 400 nanometer field of view. You have a diagonal of 400 times square root of 2. And you want to make your beam slightly bigger than the camera because your beam always moves a bit. So then you're about 600 nanometer beam. And that's below a micron, so we are in nanoprobe. And what you can then do is you can take pictures around the hole and increase your throughput. If you have a CS corrector, that's not entirely wise, as you heard from Holger Stark, because then you're still taking one picture in every hole and then in the middle. But if you don't have carbon, it starts to move, and then you want to be at the edge again. So this still depends on your specimen, but what a lot of people do is they want throughput, and they do something like this. So you're focusing here, and you're taking 5-6 images in one hole. And compared to this, that goes, of course, much, much faster. Now, that's parallel illumination. Then the daily operations. What's the other stuff you would like to tune? There's actually a quite quick trick to, again, set everything more or less in the ballpark where you want to be. Now, always press your centric focus. Never forget that. Before you start, always press your centric focus because it sets the microscope at the optimal focus setting at which it's aligned. Never do tunings away from focus. Never, ever. So you have to defocus. That means your pivot points will move over the place. It's a fact of life. Deal with it, but don't change your pivot points at a different defocus. Always use your centric focus to do all your tunings and alignments. Then you can set the sample at your centric height using the alpha wobbler, but there's also a different method. Material scientists use this. They basically focus the beam to a spot with intensity. You're not parallel then, but you fix that later. So you focus the beam to a spot on the specimen, and if the specimen is exactly at your centric height, you will have a crossover, and it will look like this. If you then move your stage up and down, you will see a ring appearing that looks like a diffraction pattern, and that's called the caustic ring. Now, there are several nice features on the caustic ring. One is that if it's circular, you can check your... You can check your objective stigmation. So if you have objective stigmation in your image, you will immediately see that in the caustic ring because it will be oval. So what you can do is you press your centric focus, you make the beam to a spot, you change Z so that you basically bring it up to a spot, and then you know then that's your centric height, and then you lower it a bit so that you see the caustic ring. Then you make the caustic ring round with objective stigmation, and you have your objective astigmatism done. Then you can also check if the central spot of the ring is in the center of the ring, because it should be. If it's not, that's rotation center, and rotation center and coma are the same. Holger Stark already mentioned it. They're controlled by the same button. So if it's like this, what you do is you go to the direct alignments again, and you activate rotation center. Now, this is normally done by wobbling, but wobbling is always difficult if you look at it for a too long time, because then it stays moving. So you take the coarse focus button, that's the big button, and you switch the wobbler off. Then you have this image, and then you simply use the multifunction button to center it, and that's actually much easier and much faster. And then, of course, you again check your adaptive astigmatism. And then you bring your specimen with Z back to the focus plane. And then we can do our pivot points. So then you're at the focus plane. Remember, we're still at eucentric height. So press eucentric focus again to make sure. And then do the pivot points. So then this starts to move. And if everything is okay, it should not move, because pivot points are only focus dependent. So if somebody else did the pivot points at a different defocus, then they move. But if everybody presses eucentric focus and does the pivot points, they will not move, because that doesn't change. So pivot points are then done, and then we're ready to go. So that's the imaging system. Then we need to choose a magnification that we want to work at. That depends on four factors. I see that it still says three factors. I have to change that. So the desired resolution, the chosen defocus, the oversampling that you want, and the sensitivity of the camera. And a lot of it has already been discussed. But for our simplicity, we're using a pixelated detector. We're not using film anymore, or most of the people don't use film anymore. So the highest resolution you can get is a black pixel, a white pixel, and a black pixel. This is resolved, and this is not. For the really young people in the audience, magnifying something that is resolved doesn't suddenly resolve it. Just shows you how badly it's not resolved. So the resolving power comes from the objective lens. And this is the smallest thing we can resolve, which is basically the center is half a pixel plus one plus half. It's 2 pixels, and that's the famous Nyquist frequency. There is super resolution. That's more or less a marketing term. Super resolution is simply an 8K camera, and then the same process applies. So Nyquist is 2 times the sampling. So if you have a 1 angstrom pixel size, Nyquist is 2 angstrom, and that's the smallest thing you can resolve. Half Nyquist is then 4, and a quarter Nyquist is 8. So if you want to have 3 angstrom resolution, you want to have at least a 1.5 angstrom pixel size. Now, what you then should also not do, if you're planning on defocusing like this, it's not useful to go to a magnification with 1.5 angstrom pixel size, because you're throwing away this whole area. So if your particles are so small that you need to apply this amount of defocus, then you also don't need to go to a magnification that has this amount of pixel size, because it makes no sense. You're limited already by the defocus. So you have to make sure that all your settings are connected with each other, because otherwise you're doing a lot of things wrong. So this basically is throwing away a lot of field of view. So if you want to defocus like this, which makes more sense, then you can get your high resolution information. And then you can decide to take a pixel size that is actually sampling half of the resolution that you desire. If you want to oversample, you have to multiply with the factor that you want to oversample. And then the camera comes into play. And this is a schematic representation. So if you have a camera that has a flat DQE curve, then it makes no sense to bin the data, because the sensitivity of the camera is everywhere the same. If you have a camera that has a curve that is higher in the beginning and lower at the end, then it makes more sense to put your desired resolution here, because you simply have much more sensitivity. However, putting your desired resolution over here, you sacrifice with field of view. So you have to make sure that your sample prep is much better. Otherwise, you mainly are shooting at ice instead of particles. So this you have to take into account your defocus. So if you decide to put your desired resolution here, you can also change your defocus such that your desired frequency is at the same range. So you have to make sure that all of these are together. Then one last thing about cameras. It has been discussed shortly. Also here, having an integration-based detector, which is the Falcon or the DE, or a counting detector, which is the K2, you can also run it in integration mode, you need to realize that these cameras change, and they change exactly in the opposite fashion to the dose rate. So if you have a Falcon, it gets better and better and better at higher dose rates, and the K2 gets worse and worse and worse at higher dose rates. So if you use a Falcon and then a K2, you have to apply exactly the opposite settings. A lot of these comparison papers are done with either these settings or these settings. So also there, if you compare these cameras, which is tricky business in the first instance because there's so many variables, you have to make sure that you use both cameras at their optimum. So if you're an owner of a Falcon, you have to use a high dose rate and a short exposure time and a relatively low magnification because you can image there. If you use a K2, you can maximize that camera by using a higher magnification, so you're here, and then you use a lower dose rate and a longer exposure time. So be aware which equipment you have and make sure you use it to the maximum. High tension is also one. This is for all CCD users in the audience. Lower your high tension because the CCD DQE gets much, much, much better. At 120 kV, a CCD camera, the good ones are more or less equal to film. Unfortunately, your sample needs to be thin, but for small particles, that's fine. You get more contrast, you have a thin sample. Of course, you have a bit more charging, but the curve of a CCD camera at 300 kV is so bad that you're better off, your camera is limiting by lowering your high tension. And then the story in the beginning comes back, you will have an unstable FEC, so you cannot work long at that, at those high tension. Direct electron detector, it makes no sense to lower the high tension because they all get worse. So, to sum up, in short, so this you can read back later when it's online. The whole thing should not take more than 15 minutes. You first determine the desired resolution, your oversample, so sampling your sensitivity, this will give you a certain pixel size. The pixel size then determines your magnification, and then you have your first thing checked. Then when you start, I always insert a cross grating, even on a side entry cryo holder. I first start with a cross grating before I put in my specimen. I press eucentric focus on a Titan, that's about 80% of the objective lens, on a TechLine, that's about 90%. If that's far off, and 83 is already miles off, then there is something wrong with your eucentric focus. Then you set eucentric height. You can do this by the alpha wobbling or by focusing to a spot and then change Z height until you see a spot. And then you lower the stage until you see the caustic ring. You do your rotation center like I showed. You do your objective astigmatism. You bring the Z height back to a spot and you do your pivot points. And then you're roughly done. Yes? Yeah. No, so that's this slide. So it says roughly coma. So if you do it according to the caustic ring, you're close, but you're not perfect. So that step, the finishing touch, comes behind that. But that is going to be so much easier if you have done this first. So then you find your parallel illumination conditions. So you basically, you switch to diffraction, you insert your objective aperture, you focus your aperture with focus, you focus the diffraction pattern with intensity, and then you're parallel. You can then measure the size of the beam, and you choose your C aperture so that your aperture matches closest to what is workable, what you want. The size of the camera, or my advice on the TechNi is simply use a 50 micron aperture and a 10 micron beam. On the Titan, it doesn't matter. You need to make sure that you're in the parallel range, and then basically the size of the beam that you choose is always dependent by the size of the camera. So if you've done all this, you should be at eucentric height, eucentric focus, parallel, illuminating your detector completely, roughly stigmated, and roughly coma-free, which comes from your rotation center. Then you switch to your desired magnification that we have calculated from here. You go to the camera, you press live mode, and you press live FFT. And you can use binning to make the FFT look slightly better. Then you do fine stigmation of your objective astigmatism. You can focus much more accurately. I then introduce a 700 nanometer defocus. It's still on the cross grating, so you can see your rings. And then you activate your coma-free alignment. What that does is it will tilt the beam left and right, and you will see that your tone rings will move inwards or change. So what you have to do is you have to turn the multifunction buttons until with every tilt the focus is the same. So you need to have the same focus or the same distance of your tone rings with the left tilt and the right tilt. If that's the case, then you have Komar-freed your microscope as good as you can by eye. And that's when Holger's story starts to kick in. If the theory is right, then you're at about 3 angstrom. You cannot do better by eye. I normally then set a 1 micron defocus. I choose the desired dose rate with spot size, so I don't change the dose rate or the dose with intensity, because intensity decides my field of view. So intensity is my C2, determines my parallel illumination or the illuminated area. It doesn't determine the dose. So please use the spot size to change the dose. And then the last bit of dose you do with exposure time. And then you take an image, and then you have this, if everything is okay. No, actually there is not. So we did some tests with changing the spot size and see. So basically, if you have a small spot size, so that most of the light goes through the C2 aperture, your coherence is less than when you have a large spot size. So the higher the spot size number, the more the beam is spread in front of your C2 aperture. So you cut off the central part of the beam, which in theory is more coherent. We've done this with a Titan. We've seen not one tone ring more. So, yeah. In theory, there is. In practice, I think you're limited by other factors than spot size. Maybe when we go to 2 angstrom resolution or beyond, we need to take care of that. But I think the spot size will be determined by the parallel illumination that you have and then the dose rate that you want. So if you're on a K2, then you are at a lower spot size because you want to use a lower dose rate to get the perfect DQE. If you're on a Falcon, you will be at a higher spot size because you want to have a higher dose rate to get the best DQE.
And if you do see an isotropic magnification, is there a way to correct it?
Go to parallel illumination. You're not parallel. So, or buy a faceplate. That's another option. It's an expensive option, but the moment you put in a faceplate, you have to be parallel. So a faceplate only works, like Rado said, when you're at parallel illumination. So if you have a faceplate, that could also be a nice option. The moment you see the blow-up point on the faceplate, but that's not here to explain, we'll explain it when you have one, then when you're at the blow-up point of the faceplate, you're per definition parallel illuminating your specimen. Could be. There's a lot of issues that I've been seeing come by that I know were not parallel. And some comparisons also. So just read the papers. You now know where it is. If you see in the paper they use the 1 micron beam on a Techni with a 150 micron aperture and they're stuck at 7.5 angstrom, yeah. Doesn't have to be, but at least the optics were not parallel. Sorry, can you repeat that?
So you were talking about this difference in mag and X versus Y, right?
Yep.
How is not being parallel going to affect that?
Oh, maybe we're mixing things up.
Yeah.
So if you're mentioning the anisotropic magnification of the projector system, that has nothing to do with parallel illumination.
Yeah.
That has something to do with the imperfection of the lenses and the fact that when you go to low magnification, you cannot accurately align your microscope anymore. So if I have a clock on the wall and I need to accurately align it to 1 minute accuracy from here on, it will be difficult. So if I go towards the clock, I can exactly set it. So aligning a microscope at 20,000 times magnification is not going to be that accurate than doing it at 60 or 100,000 magnification. So, by definition, there will be a spread in yeah, in microscope quality, there is a number on it, on how accurate you can do it. And then it's simply kind of luck. If you have one lens will be better than the other. Yeah, but Holger does that with a Titan in parallel illumination. So if he's parallel illuminating his specimen and you then go over and under focus and you still see magnification changes, then that is that anisotropic magnification. So if you know you're parallel and you still see it, then it's that. The only way to correct is go to higher mag or to buy a CS corrector. The magnification you're working at. Oh, but this one. So if you go this coarse one, the pivot points are not magnification dependent, and these two are also not so, because these are coarsely setting your coma and coarsely setting your objective astigmatism. But the fine-tuning you do on the camera, and the camera has a 1 angstrom pixel size. So if you're on the K2, you're effectively at 20,000 times magnification on the microscope, but what you see on the camera is sampling at 1 angstrom. So your objective astigmatism will be corrected very well. But since the projector system is at the low magnification, the strength of the projector system is very weak and therefore introduces aberrations, and that is this. So microscopes are not built to work at very high resolution at low magnification. They're built to work at high resolution at high magnification. And an unfortunate side effect of a very small pixel size is that you have to go to low magnification. Spot size dependent gun shift.
So that's just it.
Yeah.
What about if you're changing mag and the beam seems to wander?
That's the projector system.
So what alignment is that? The beam alignment?
One of them. There is one alignment. I don't know that one by heart. But it depends. So if the beam moves by doing something, if you say I'm changing magnification, you're changing the projector system. So if then the beam moves because you're changing the projector system, it's somewhere in the magnification part. So then you shouldn't find that alignment in the condenser system. However, if it's wrong, you have to do the full column alignment.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter at which step it is, because you need to do every step.
I get it. I was just curious.